Wake Up America, time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, the H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information Please at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. If we use your question, the H.J. Heinz Company will send $10 in war stamps, plus a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If we muff the question, you get $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information Please is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenthal. And now, our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman.
Traveling along on his carefree, unforeseeable path, Information Please tonight offers as its board of experts our veteran trio, John Kieran of the New York Sun, Franklin P. Adams, and Oscar Levant. And as our special guest, a visitor from our great ally. He's the famous Englishman, Hilary St. George Saunders, who is half of the pseudonymous writers Francis Beeding and David Pilgrim, and also may be known to many of you as the author of the current best-selling book about the commandos, known as Combined Operations. Before we begin, we should like to acknowledge with sincere thanks the fact that the 1943 Father's Day Committee has awarded this year's Medal of Excellence to Information Please. The committee has honored us for our work in the selling of war bonds. And in connection with this bond campaign, we'd like to point out that we will make two more bond stops this season. One in Chicago at the Civic Opera House on June 28th, and one in San Francisco at the Opera House on July 12th, and we're looking forward to both of them. We're going to begin with a question that comes to us from Elizabeth W. Silbert of Jamaica, New York. This is about operations, Mr. Saunders. I don't know whether they're combined or not. What famous operations of this war took this period of time to be completed in? The first took the period of 84 days. 84 days, Mr. Saunders.
The Battle of Britain.
Yes, can you name the days?
From the 12th of August, the 8th of August, 1940, to the 31st of October, 1941.
That's exactly right, and I imagine that many Englishmen will remember those exact dates for the rest of their lives.
Yes, they're not likely to forget them.
I imagine not. Mr. Levant?
The first bombing by Germany over Britain, I think, was in March.
No, the 9th of May was the first time they actually attacked the country. They had, as you're quite right, in March they did drop a bomb. I think it killed a rabbit in the Orkneys.
How about a famous operation of this war that took just one day less than 6 months? One day less than 6 months, Mr. Levant?
The Tunisian campaign.
That's quite right, yes. I wonder whether you can give us the date.
I could give you the months, from December to May, just like Jimmy Walker, Will You Love Me, so forth.
That's approximately it, Mr. Levant. November 8th was the landing, 1942, and the occupation was completed on May 7th, 1943, just one day under 6 months. I imagine that was a combined operation, Mr. Saunders.
It certainly was. I can tell you one story of it, which I thought was rather good. He sent one of our commandos over, and he had half Americans and half British. And the Americans were commanded by British officers, and the British by American officers. And they did a very good
worked
job.
Worked out all right.
Yeah, it did. It worked out
it's
fine.
A
well combined operation.
Yes, it is. Now, what operation took just 19 days for its completion? 19 days, gentlemen, Mr. Levant.
The bombing and the Pantelleria.
Yes, you make it sound like cigars.
Pantelleria.
Pantelleria, Mr. Adams reminded. Took 19 days.
It became a cigar after the 19 days.
That gives us three operations out of three. Try this one from G. Bennett of Exeter, New Hampshire. You don't mind switching to literature, Mr. Saunders?
I don't know anything about literature.
Well, do you mind switching to heavy drinkers?
Not a bit, no.
That apparently is a little different. Where in literature would you find each of these heavy drinkers? One, a lawyer. Where would you find a lawyer, Mr. Levant?
The Tale of Two Cities.
That's quite right. Who was it?
Cotton.
That's right. Sidney Cotton.
Also, William Pitt. I don't want to bring up the British government. He used to like his port. He was a lawyer, I think.
Yes, he is a lawyer, but it was a good thing that he wasn't in fiction, because
he was pretty good.
He was all right. That's okay, isn't it?
Yes, it's okay. Right.
Now, where in literature would you find a heavy drinker who was also, on the side, a henpecked husband? Well, maybe in consequence.
Rip Van Winkle.
Rip Van Winkle, yes. Yes. You're an expert in heavy drinking, Mr. Rip.
I don't drink.
You have time to look these things up. And where would you find a heavy drinker who was a father, a famous father? No Father's Day award for him. Who was it? Mr. Adams, you're a sort of professional father.
Yes, but I can't afford to drink being a father.
Mr. Saunders?
Well, I don't know whether it would be full stop. I don't know whether he was a father. No. He tried very hard to be.
Well, I have no doubt he succeeded, but not for publication.
He married Mrs. Pixie,
didn't he? Well, Mr. Adams.
Noah.
Noah?
Quite right, yes.
Noah, that's perfectly right. Yes. Was he a heavy drinker, though?
That's what the boys say.
I have one.
No, the girls.
The boys in the arc room? Mr. LeVan?
Beethoven's father didn't mind drinking.
Yes, but he isn't in literature either. I think the character in Ten Nights in a Barroom, Joe Morgan, the drunkard, is the most famous father who was a drinker. Do you remember him, Mr. Adams?
No.
All right, I'll take Noah.
I know the father, dear father, come home with me now with quite a heavy
drink. Well, I want him to say it. Try this. Janet W. Warren of Maplewood, New Jersey, sends this rather interesting question in. Where does a man have to wear a hat in order to raise a point of order? Mr. Saunders.
In the House of Commons, England.
Yes, and why should that be so?
It's a very old custom. I can't tell you the exact date. It dates back to at least the 15th century.
It seems an odd custom to
us. He has to be seated and covered, that is to say, wearing a hat, when he raises a point of order during a division, that is to say, when the House is voting. I remember once seeing Lady Astor, the first lady woman member of Parliament.
Yes, we know about her.
We'll know about her, I expect. Yes. She had to borrow a silk hat, I believe, one of the...
There's a man who just wears a hat. He gets a lot of money for it. What's that man's name, sir?
Is that right, Mr. Curran?
Oh, no.
Well, of course, that has nothing to do with raising the parliamentary point of order, though it's interesting and no doubt useful.
Old hat.
Where does a man wear two different hats during the same game? Not at the same time, necessarily. Mr. Curran.
Well, a catcher or a batter in baseball, for instance. Now they wear the shockproof skull caps to prevent beating, and then they throw away that if they reach first base.
Yes, quite right. And where does a man wear a straw hat while working indoors? Mr. Carey.
Well, a butcher generally wears a straw hat.
Who?
A butcher.
Never heard
of it. It's a sign of trade.
Butcher wears a straw hat.
Where do you see a butcher nowadays?
In the back market.
Yes, as Mr. Carey reminds us, dear dead days of yore, a butcher in a meat market wears a straw hat. Do you know why that should be so, Mr. Carey?
No, I don't
know
any more than why an umpire in a cricket game wears a straw hat.
I don't know. It's just
he doesn't always.
Why a horse used to wear a straw hat.
Just as funny. You know, everything connected with wearing hats is very funny, Mr. Adams. I really begin to think so. Try this one. These are too easy. See if we can toughen them up. This is E.I. Reed of Wilmington, California. Ask this question. If the United Nations invading armies of Europe moved up each of these river valleys that I'm going to mention, where would they enter and in what direction would they strike? Now, suppose they moved up the Rhine Valley. About what part of Europe would they enter, and in what direction would they travel? Mr. Saunders.
Well, they get eventually into the Ruhr, and then if they...
Well, first, where would they start? They'd start
in Holland.
Yes, yes, that's quite right.
Where are they here?
In Holland.
Oh.
The Nederrijn, I guess it's called. And what direction would they travel then?
Well, roughly southwest.
Southeast is quite right. East into Germany and then south, as Mr. Adams reminds us. Now, how about, we're not making any suggestions, of course, to our, that's in, and how about the Rhone Valley? Mr. Curran.
They would come in, they would go across the Mediterranean and enter at Marseille and go right up through Avignon and Lyon, right through the center of France, smack into Germany, I hope.
Right.
Well, they go, that takes a little bit to the west of Marseille.
But generally northward of France.
Well, yes.
I mean, to be absolutely particular.
They'd see some awfully nice country on the way, wouldn't they?
They certainly wouldn't. A lot of very good wine.
How about Avignon water?
I like water.
Yeah. how about the Vardar Valley? V-A-R-D-A-R. That's a tough one, Mr. Saunders.
No, that they would go up from Salonika through the Balkans in roughly northwesterly direction.
Into what country?
Oh, through Bulgaria into Romania.
Well, Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia and then on to Romania.
Yes, quite right. Well, that gives us three methods out of three. And anybody's welcome to any of those three methods. I shouldn't be surprised, would you, Mr. Saunders, if one of them might conceive the
would be? No, I'd be a bit surprised.
Not a bit.
I don't know.
Surprise us on this program. Try this one from Rhodes Berman, New York City. This is a musical question, gentlemen. Which of the characters mentioned in the songs you are about to hear are eligible for marriage? Is that perfectly clear? Let's have the first. Mr. Levine.
The Merry Widow, if she has enough money.
Yes, she would be eligible, not to say eager. That would be quite right. Now, how about the second? Mr. Levine.
I think I would not consider that age eligible, would you?
What age is it?
I think it's 2.
It is 2.
Well, that's a little young.
It is a little young, yes. It's a little young.
Mandy is 2
is the song, and the third and last. Mr. Adams.
Frederick in the Pirates of Penzance, who was not eligible on account of his...
Discretion. How old was he?
21.
About 21, yes. Well, we got 3 out of 3 on that. Now our 57 Varieties reporter has a message of vital importance to every mother and father of a teenage boy. Mr. Grauer.
Your boy wants a part in winning this war. And we at Heinz, because we are familiar with the farm labor shortage and its possible menace to victory, think that one of the worthiest contributions he could make is by joining the Boy Scouts of America. This great character-building organization has pledged 100 million vitally needed hours to helping the nation's farmers this summer. By becoming a member of the Boy Scouts, your boy will accomplish far more than helping relieve the current food shortage. He'll learn the principles of farming, earn money, and enjoy such helpful, constructive scout activities as woodcraft, hiking, and swimming. According to the Scout Farm Plan, which varies in different parts of the country, your son may either do gardening and poultry work in his own city, live in an organized camp, do day hall work,
And with this one from Mrs. E. Eisen of New York City. I want you to recite lines for us that mention 3 different foods that you might buy in a dairy. Any lines of poetry or prose that are well enough known?
Dairy, you said.
A dairy, yes. Sure. You don't know what a dairy is. Mr. Adams, you explain to Mr. Levant what a dairy is.
Sour cream.
And pot cheese.
Well, a dairy is something that you keep a record of by day.
And now, sir, you've explained it.
You're going to give 3 in one?
No. 3 different lines about 3 different kinds of food.
Where are you going, my pretty maid?
Don't buy maids in a dairy,
she said.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Is that dairy?
Yes, I thought you were going to sell the maid. Mr. Kieran?
I'm sorry, I had the same food. He's too full of the milk of human kindness to do the dirty deed, Macbeth.
Very good, yes, and more classical. Mr.
He's a rat, he likes cheese. All right.
I see we're over the plate carefully. I'm not certain I can quote it. Butter and eggs and a pound of cheese.
Oh, there we have all three.
The old wife sat at her ivy door.
That's it. Butter and eggs, she'd freak. And something
yes, butter and eggs all
something.
Together in one line. That's a combined operation for you. Quite right.
By Thea Calverly.
There's a Mr. Kieran?
Well, cheese and butter, only Falstaff pronounced it after the Welshman, cheese and butter, and Falstaff said, have I lived to stand at the mock of a man who makes frippers of English?
You. Yeah,
but you
beautiful.
Remember that what he really liked was a monstrous deal of sack. He wasn't any good on that
Mr. Adams?
And feed upon strawberry, sugar, and cream.
Have we had enough food now, Mr. Adams?
That's satisfy
even you. Yes, cream's all right. Very good. Try this. Mrs. Ruth Grossman sends this one in. If visiting cards with each of the following insignia were left on your card tray, who, in fact or fiction, might you assume had called? If you just saw the insignia on the card, for example, a butterfly. Suppose you...
Hi,
who was he?
Well, heavens.
I have to learn.
Well, he was an American etcher and painter who did most of his work in England, and he signed the butterfly as his signature.
Yes, that's right.
He also said, you will, Oscar, you will.
To you?
Well, Oscar Wilde, just a little bit.
He was also expelled from the United States Military Academy.
Yeah. Right. I think, does that finish, Mr. Whisper? Are we through with him? Okay. Try this. Suppose the insignia on the card was a B. A B-E-E. Mr. Saunders.
Oh, well, B. A B might have been something to do with Napoleon. The B was Napoleon's effigy.
His emblem.
Trademark. Yeah. Right.
Jack Benny, I saw.
Pardon?
Jack Benny.
I don't think Jack Benny leaves cards. Mr. Adams?
Well, there's a whole deck of cards called B cards. B on the back.
Well, I certainly find them on B deck in any case, Mr. Adams.
I called on those cards, Press.
At least there was one that was named that and had it painted on the side and did a pretty good job out in the
You bet. What is a spoof, Mr. Kieran?
It's a combination between a swan and a goose.
It's one of those combined operations, Mr. Kieran.
Yes, done by Lieutenant Colonel Kurtz. That's a grand story.
Very good.
Frank Kurtz, I met him. I know him. He's a swell chap.
He must be a man. And where do you find this story, Mr. Kieran?
Well, he was...
if you wanted to read the story, where would you find it? Mr. Saunders?
Queen's Died Proudly by Mr. White.
Yes, W.L. White, a very good book. Parentheses, ADV, close parentheses. That goes. We go on with a question from Mr. W.A. Nichols of Beaumont, Texas. Who carried these things off and where? Who carried off a railroad car and where? A railroad car, Mr. Levant.
You mean carried it off personally?
Well, not personally, no.
Well, Hitler took the Compiègne Armistice car. He took it, probably will take it back in a few days.
Yes, that's one of those railroad cars going to make a round trip. Yes, as Mr. Levant tells us, he took it from the forest of Compiègne after...
You have an American accent, whereas I don't.
...until 1940. Why did he take that railroad car, Mr. Levant?
He is a vindictive man, I've heard.
We don't like nasty remarks on this program. Well, it has a special meaning, does it not, the railroad car?
Well, the original armistice of 19... I've forgotten the First World War.
1918.
Was signed in that car, with Bosch directing the terms.
Yes.
In psychoanalysis, it means a resolving of an old trauma. That's going too deep for you.
Way over my head. Who carried off the Lions of St. Mark? The Lions of St. Mark. Mr. Saunders.
Napoleon.
During what period of his life?
Well, I can't remember exactly the date, but when he took the Venetian Republic, round about 1800, I guess, a year or two later, I think,
yes.
He took them off, and he took them to, and he put them on top of an Arc de Triomphe that he built in the Tuileries Gardens, or just in front of the Tuileries Palace.
All dictators seem to have the same vulgar understandings of St. Mark.
Well, they were
written by G.A. Henty.
They're on Fifth Avenue in front of the library.
They're different lions. Well, they were later returned to Venice. I guess Venice still has them.
Yes,
now.
They got that.
Yeah. Now, how about someone who carried off...
Oh, there were some lions in Trafalgar Square. Maybe it's something to do with...
Those are your own lions.
Yes, those are your own. You've got them. They're going to stay there. How about someone who carried off a castle, stone by stone, Mr. Levant?
Well, Hearst, W.R., did one, stone by stone.
That's true.
And there was a picture called The Ghost
Goes West.
Yes, in which that was one of the motifs of the plot.
Incidentally, Robert Sherwood wrote the script of that. He's in the government service now.
A friend of yours, apparently. Yes, that's quite true.
I should say he is.
We never dare admit that in England.
Was he a friend of mine, or did he write the picture?
No, he was in government service.
Oh, we have nobody in this country who isn't, Mr. Saunders. Melbourne Bergerman of this city, New York, sends this one in. Name the novel or play or movie in which the following situations occur. In the first case, a wife flirts with a man so that her husband can win his money at cards. Is that clear, Mr. Adams?
Sounds like Vanity Fair to me.
Exactly, yes. Vanity Fair. Who are the characters involved, Mr. Adams?
Rawdon Crawley.
Quite right.
And Becky Sharp.
Yeah.
And
who's the third angle in the triangle?
I forget who the other one is. Marcus and Stein.
He's the one, no, he's the one everybody forgets.
Was Miriam Hopkins in the picture? I bet nobody remembers that.
Nobody except you. It was George Osborne. That's the man with not very much character. Isn't that right, Mr. Kieran? Everybody forgets all about him. How about this situation? A girl plays poker with a sheriff for her lover's life. Mr. Kieran.
Girl in the Golden West.
That's right.
The opera.
Very good, yes. Minnie's fallen in love, it says here, with Ramirez, who is an outlaw. How about a situation in which a gambler helps a refugee couple by fixing his own roulette game?
There's a lot of gambling about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't there a lot of gambling?
That isn't Rick in Casablanca, is it?
It is indeed.
It is. Huh?
Right, Casablanca. Uh-huh. And who played Casablanca?
Humphrey Bogart.
Good, I just wanted to make you feel comfortable. Now, here's a different sort of question from one of our listeners. She's noticed several different spellings of the word ketchup, and she wants to know which is right. That question's a natural for our Heinz expert. How about it, Ben Brower?
Well, the big unabridged Webster dictionary gives three spellings. Catsup, that's cat like a kitten, sup as in supper. It also lists catchup, catches with a ball, and up as in upstairs. And then, of course, it gives the spelling K-E-T-C-H-U-P, ketchup, as you see it on the famous 57 label of a bottle of Heinz tomato ketchup. This spelling, by the way, is characteristic of Heinz. I don't believe you'll find it in any other brand. As a matter of fact, that spelling is closest to the original Malay word meaning taste or flavor. For you see, the forerunner of our present-day ketchup was an Oriental sauce, much prized by the wise old potentates of the East, and brought to England by seafaring gentlemen in the 17th century. In English novels, you read of different ketchups, walnut, mushroom, grape, or currant, but the best known by far, the best selling, and possibly the most popular condiment sauce in all the world, is that rich, full-bodied blend of rare spices, pure sugar, and red ripe pedigreed tomatoes. That's ketchup. K-E-T-C-H-U-P. Heinz tomato ketchup.
A very good answer, Mr. Brower. And now, gentlemen, let's tighten up, shall we? We ought to get 3 out of 3 on these. Here's one from Sarah G. Fisher of Bridgeton, New Jersey. What are the signs by which you'd know that these crops were ready for harvesting in your victory garden? And I assume all of you gentlemen have a victory garden. How would you know that onions were ready, if ever?
My wife was crying.
Well, you have a funny garden, Mr. Levant. Mr. Kieran, you're an old gardener.
Well, I don't know about the tame onions. I don't eat them. But the wild ones, there's a flower comes out at the top, and by that time there's a bulb at the bottom of the root, and you eat the bulb.
That sounds reasonable to me. Would you care to contradict him, Adams?
I don't contradict him, but you can see a little white coming out of the ground when they're supposed to be ripe. I know this by hearsay alone. And we have them in the garden.
Good. Good for you. Now, how about corn? How would you know that corn is ready for harvesting? Mr. Kieran again.
The corn silk is dark, and it's a golden green or yellowish when it's in the milk, as we say, we farmers. And then as it ripens, why, the corn silk gets dark. Where the corn is ripe, and you can smoke the corn silk.
Behind the barn. Is that right, Mr. Adams?
Right.
Is that the way your corn behaves, too?
It will in about 6 weeks.
Goody. Cucumbers, finally. Cucumbers. How do you know when they're ready for harvest?
When you get indigestion.
That's approximately right, Mr.
You look at them.
Yes.
Do they smile?
Depends who looks at them, Mr. Levant.
They kind of drop off the vine-like.
Well, I think that Mr. Kieran...
Look at them, you pick them when they're ripe.
You pick them whenever you feel like it.
Soon throw them away.
Besides, as soon as they're exercised, you like. Yes. If we've given a lot of false information to some victory gardeners tonight, please do not write into information, please. Nicholas Lenemsky of Boston, Massachusetts, asks this one. Again,
he's tough.
Oh, you know him.
Oh, he's a great musicologist.
Oh, is he a musicologist?
I should say he is.
Let's see if we can direct these at you, then. In the communiques of what nations at war are these phrases frequently encountered? We ought
That's
to get
not
to
music.
What did you say?
I thought he was a musician.
Well, he knows something else, too, unlike us. quote, there were no important changes on the front last night. Close quote. Mr. Levant.
That's usually a Russian communique. Yes. The usual optimism. And they're noncommittal until an operation, I think, is at an end.
That would be right, Mr. Saunders. You're, as a military historian, you
certainly would, but it applies to almost any communique from any belligerent in any country.
Well, I think more particularly the Russians seem to be very cautious about announcing changes in the front. I think Mr. Levant is right.
The Germans usually make the announcements 2 weeks sometimes ahead.
Now, suppose this were the phrasing of the communique. Quote, damage was confined to civilian installations and a hospital was hit. What nation? Mr. Kieran.
It sounds like Germany or Japan.
Yes.
Choice of one.
Germany.
I
think so. Yeah,
we've forgotten Italy.
Yes, but I think
mainly
Germany.
I think they're
Germany,
too stunned to issue any communiques at all.
And now suppose you read this one. From the above operations, all of our aircraft and crews returned safely. Now, what nation might that quite conceivably be? Mr. Adams?
It might be Great Britain.
Well, it might be, Mr. Saunders.
I don't think so. We wouldn't mention the word crew.
You would not?
No. We would say all of our aircraft return safely.
What would you say, what nation would you say?
It sounds more like the United States.
Yes, I should think it would be, Mr. Levant.
I was going to say Warner Brothers and Air Force, that picture.
That would be right. I hope Mr. Sininski is satisfied with what our own musicology has done for us.
What
try this. Jesse Duell of Ukiah, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, California. I certainly am pronouncing that correctly. Ukiah, I'm informed. Send this one in. I want you to recite for us a line of poetry that includes the words once, twice, and thrice. I think we ought to get thrice out of thrice on that. Mr. Adams?
Once upon a midnight dreary.
That is a very good one, but that is the easiest one. Now, how about twice? A line of poetry that has the word twice in it, Mr. Levant.
Kiss me once, then again, and there's not even twice in it. I'm sorry.
No, you got the operation, but you haven't got the word, Mr. Saunders.
Weave a something round in thrice, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk.
Weave a circle.
Circle, round, that's it. Well, I don't think it's thrice.
Right. Weave a circle round his head, for he on honeydew hath fed. No, thrice is right.
Thrice, I think.
Drunk the milk of paradise.
Yes, I know. Right. I can't understand why he's been tight on the milk of paradise.
That's the one, Mr. Saunders. Very good. Cheap but good. How about the word twice, though?
Tall tales.
True. True.
Or you met the gentleman.
And that is, is that not told, Mr. Adams, is what you meant, isn't it?
Tiddies, is it?
I said, is it twice told? Come along, Mr. Adams, say yes.
Yes, but I don't know what it's from.
What's it from? Well, that's honest. What's it from, Mr. Kieran?
I don't know.
Othello? No, I'm not sure.
If Mr. Kieran doesn't know, that represents a new record.
Then you can tear up Mr. Adams.
Mr. Adams, you better consider yourself torn up. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3 on that, which means that we've made a perfect score.
Oh, dear.
Thank you, Mr. Saunders. Tonight, the H.J. Hines Company, as I say, has paid out no dollars in war bonds and stamps to the great confusion of Mr. Morgenthau and no sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, Mr. Adams and Mr. Kieran will be reinforced by our old friend, the famous author, Christopher Morley, and the Dean of Vassar College, Dr. C. Mildred Thompson. Remember, send your questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, Ben Grauer.
If your son is already a Boy Scout, help him to take part in the Scout Farm Plan. If he doesn't belong to this great organization, the H.J. Hines Company wishes you good health and good evening, and invites you to help stump the experts again next Monday night at the same time.